I came back from Sydney a couple of weeks or so before launch, and probably 2 to 3 weeks when we when I left, and they were still doing repairs and fixing. I came back to Goddard to oversee the Madrid and Goldstone operation, and then to go to Houston, the Manned Space Flight Center, for the mission itself, so I'd be in a console position to talk to all the sites during the actual mission and landing. We still didn't know for sure which site would be primary. We knew that theoretically it would be Australia, and the use of honeysuckle and or parks or a combination of them was the plan in general. That's why we got the parks dish, but it could also have been Goldstone, who had a 210-foot dish. So when the mission launched, that's where I went, was to Houston. I'd been spending a lot of time in Houston throughout Apollo. I probably went down there at least once every month for 3, 4, 5 days, meeting with the Houston people in television-oriented meetings. That's where I first met the infamous Ed Findell, who was later became the controller, the comm manager, or I forget what his title was, INCO, I think it was, communications folks that ran the remote-controlled camera, which was the subsequent missions when we remotely controlled the pan tilt, etc., on the color cameras and watch launch, etc., and that was his job. But Ed Findell was one of those who was against flying TV on the mission. When I met him, it wasn't so much a discussion of whether to fly or not. It was a discussion of the fact that we were preparing to be capable of having TV. And there was always a kind of a competition going on as to the importance and need of Goddard versus Houston. Houston, Manned Space Flight Center, always had kind of an attitude that we don't need Goddard. We could do the ground tracking without having a separate center, and it was a constant battle of who's in charge of what, with the knowledge that Houston is the final call as to funding, and just as it is today as far as manned flight, when they have the pocketbook that funds these different support areas. So anyways, that's where I spent a lot of time preparing, running simulations in what we call the ESTL, Electronic Simulation and Test Laboratory. That is in building 440 or 44, I can't remember now, I think it was 440. And we still run stuff of the nature of ISS and shuttle TV from there. But they had a complete spacecraft makeup, and we could run all our simulations. We did more post-Apollo 11 in that facility than for Apollo 11. We did a lot of sequential. We did a lot of threshold testing. Our equipment that we use in the ground network was basically broadcast equipment designed for signal-to-noise ratios that were much higher than we could ever achieve. So we ran a lot of tests at Houston to see which broadcast models would lock onto low signal noise signals the best. And we had kind of like competitions between companies that would come in, and we would run it through the simulation system and take it down to threshold and see which ones perform better than others as to what we considered still usable video. Back to Apollo 11, I went down there, and I was assigned to a Building 30 control center area where we handled all the interface to the tracking sites. Ed Tarkington was there. He was ops. I was there kind of what you would call consultant, but available, hoping there wouldn't be a problem. And that's kind of where I resided when this mission went off, and sat there, and we had no known problems. Unfortunately, the problems we had were kind of instantaneous, and they were setup problems, as you know, as far as a Goldstone scan converter, etc. There wasn't anything that was instantly going to be corrected at the time, since we didn't know that we were going to come out early to begin with. The astronauts, I think it was 2 or 3 hours early, and that's when Goldstone all of a sudden was a prime site for the first step. or for close to the first step, and that's where we had a lot of scan converter problems. Nothing failed that I know of, but we didn't have prime operators that were scheduled to be there to support the predicted times, and that again was one of the things in the TV world that if you were assigned as a USB S-band receiver operator or a telemetry expert, these people were trained through very formal classes at what we called the Network Test and Training Facility at Goddard, NTTF, and assigned to the tracking sites. They came in and ran many, many days of training in every area that they were support. It wasn't until years later that we ever had a TV course or had a TV training plan. TV was always, you know, that's kind of neat if you can do it, but it was never part of the original network design for official support and training. Therefore, we did training on the fly. We used Bendix engineers such as Ted Knotts and Dick Hall and others to train on the fly operators on either scan converter or even sequential color, developed our own courses. And so even though it was a very good effort and it was well done in my opinion, it was not done until years later on a professional basis where you could really certify and know that everybody could do what they had to. We would run our own simulations to a certain level, but we never had the support or acceptance that we could actually tie up a whole site and run simulations and institute problems to be corrected. And you know, there are two things. One, it wasn't on the agenda as a major support like USB S-band receivers or telemetry recorders were. Secondly, there was very little time to do all that. We were on the fly installing, checking out, and getting ready for each mission. It was not done in a long-term basis where we knew years ahead that we were going to fly TV like we knew we were going to have S-band. So we did the best we could, and I was in Houston, like I said, and we all know the results. The results were excellent historically. They could have been better at some areas video-wise. We had some great video in Australia. We had some pretty bad video Goldstone. We had some good video Goldstone. But a lot of this had to do not with the antennas and whether it was an 85 or 210-foot dish. Of course, a 210-foot dish was better than an 85 signal noise. But as far as quality of TV, it was all about the converters and getting the signal back to Houston. So we had lots of success in Australia and not a lot of success at Goldstone. But historically, we accomplished what we wanted to. And honestly speaking, the public could have cared less probably what the quality was at the time. They were caught up in the moment of seeing anything from the moon. And so we were very happy with the result. Probably wasn't really concerned about the quality until after the mission and looking at what next mission we'd have, and then slow scan went away and it became a non-issue and it was all about sequential color quality. It wasn't until 2004 or 5 when we started looking for lost tapes that we really started talking about quality. In fact, you were probably one of the primary or the primary instigator, you, Colin McKellar, as to can't we do better? And where are the tapes? And why can't we use those now and digitize them? So that's a whole nother story that has been documented, and we can talk about that someday if you want my view on everything. But that's when we started looking at the real quality and what occurred in 1969. Whereas probably from 69 on, I wasn't even thinking about that. I was into sequential color, and then I was into Apollo Soyuz and Skylab and AIDSAT, which was a mission out of Madrid. So we were kind of moving ahead fast until we got to shuttle, and shuttle became a kind of a repetitive project. So that was kind of it at Houston. Like I say, I spent a lot of time there during missions for support of the sites. I spent a lot of time in between missions there running tests at the ESTL lab and going to meetings about TV's use and how we use it in the network, and where we'll use it from.
So on the day of the Apollo 11 lunar television, so you were in the same room with Ed Tarkington and others, is that where you were? Or where you,
yes, he was at a different console, but I was in the same room.
Okay. And there were a number of different recorders running there as well?
No. Those recorders were in a different area of the building. They had them in Building 8 and Building 30, but it was in a different area where they actually recorded the video from where we operated, as far as just console and communications interface. Now, that was, of course, all converted video coming into Houston, so there was no slow scan, but it was all converted, fed from the sites.
And it was still pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah. Like I say, other than the initial Goldstone, of course, our perspective on it was, we had a couple of perspectives. The first one is, can we get a downlink signal? Can we lock onto it? And will we see anything that makes sense? And we knew it was all possible, but nobody really had a absolute feeling as to what our link margin calculations and expectations were compared to what the real world was going to produce. So when we had a downlink and locked on, even though it was upside down, we were thrilled that we had a signal. So at that point, it was kind of all a blur, because right prior to that downlink, that's when they said, they're coming out early, Dick, and it better work, meaning not the camera, but the ground sites, because I was at Houston, so it was kind of like, we know everything we do is fine,
yes.
But your ground sites better work. And I kind of carried that forward after the mission. I've always said that since then, that I participated, be it Apollo Soyuz or shuttle or space station, ISS, launch TV. Every time I go to these meetings and they talk about the millions of dollars they're spending on the spacecraft to put this stuff on to do the following, I'm always kind of enjoying my response that, you know, I can cause this multi-million dollar project go down the tubes by just one $200 amplifier at the site. So
yes.
You guys need to pay a little more attention to what we do on the ground.
In terms of knowing what to expect when the Apollo 11 camera came on, I'm always surprised looking at it to see how quickly Bruce McCandless, as the Capcom, worked out that the picture was upside down.
That's funny you mention that. I, of course, didn't recall any of that. I recall it was upside down and was corrected. But I have no idea how he knew that.
Mm.
I still don't know when I watch it now how he immediately said it's upside down. Because I was trying to figure out what I was looking at. Now, being knowledgeable of the spacecraft design, he probably sees that picture totally different than I did. And he probably can look at one strut and say, that's upside down. But I didn't know that. And I was sitting there saying, what? What's he talking about? So... yeah, that was interesting.
And I guess there was a fair bit of pressure on the poor video tech at Goldstone to have that switch the right way, and he switched.
Well, there was a lot of pressure, and we had gone through all kinds of procedures on this situation as to where the camera would be mounted at first and where it would be mounted later when we threw the switch. It seems that it didn't fall on deaf ears. It only fell on the ears of the person who wasn't there because they went out early.
Mm.
So we really couldn't count. If you had three operators and a fourth for vacation and sickness doing TV on eight-hour shifts, we had no system, like I said, training and otherwise, that we felt overly confident that all operators at any time of the day or night knew exactly what to do. It was... it's one of the things that was so scary about this mission when it came to TV was there's a group of us, just like the group that you and I and John and Stan LaBar searched for tapes. You had a small group of people that were trying to control the network and make it work without really having the support and funding they needed to do it on a high-level basis. So it all came back to, well, it's TV. And we may carry TV on to the moon, and we may not. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And, you know, whatever. And it wasn't until you got there that it was the only thing that anyone cared about.
Okay.
So you didn't fund an event worldwide that became the event.
Yes, I mean, it really did
you
become
know, saying
the event,
we landed
it?
On the moon. That was history. They're already on the moon now. Now, what's the event? The event is seeing it. End of story. And how much did you spend on getting ready to see it? Very little in comparison to everything else, and rightfully so to some level. But it was just done the best we could with what they were giving us and the approvals they were giving us to move ahead with this on the basis that it might be used. So it was always, we were always on the edge. Kind of funny you ask that question because you think about these things as you're speaking. And we were always mission to mission. Are we going to have TV or are we not going to have TV? We were never locked in where we were doing a job that we knew was going to be used. And it added a kind of a stress level that was not good. But we were so busy, I guess, we were fine with it. But it was always, are they going to have TV or are they not going to have TV, and so forth and so on.
Did you get much feedback from people after the Apollo 11 TV, within NASA, or was it that was nice and just a part of the whole thing that worked?
No, and after it was over, they just basked in the glory. and so there was a lot of feedback, and they were thrilled. And they gave me awards and promotions and stuff. So everybody properly appreciated, whether or not because they gave me something, but did they understand at that point the importance of TV? It's kind of like there were a lot that made the right decision and a lot who fought the right decision. Did they understand how bad their decision would have been if they hadn't carried TV? Never heard that feedback. I would love to ask, what did you think after Apollo 11? I have not heard that response. The right decision was made, and whether it worked or not is irrelevant. It's what you're trying to do that's important, and you're trying to bring history to the world, and that's all you can do. And the only criticism I would have is not that the right decision wasn't made. My criticism is that decision should have been made years before and then funded and treated as just as important an element of this mission as any other.
And set in concrete.
Yeah, and that would have set up the training and everything else, and so some of these little anomalies probably would have never happened if it had been done properly from the beginning. Because it affects manpower, it affects everything.
It affects morale, doesn't it?
To ask a site to support TV that's not a quote-unquote hard requirement, it becomes also a matter of how many people we hire to do TV support out here if we don't know we're going to actually use it. So, yep, that's what we did.
Stan LeBeau was also in Houston for the EVA.
Yeah,
was
I did
he?
Not into Stan. Now, Stan's kind of like a superhero, see? So he was kept from the peons. Stan was probably smoking cigars and drinking wine with Chris Kraft, and I was having a beer and pretzels with the engineers. So that was Stan. Stanley was not intentionally aloof, but because he, and rightfully so, was the key player in getting a camera on the moon to work, he was treated positively in that manner and probably negatively if it didn't work, but he was a key element. Like I say, anyone that builds a $3, $4, $5 million camera go on the moon and it works is going to get credit, but that camera isn't going to do a thing without that $250 amplifier working on the ground. And these people never understood that. They always assumed that if the camera worked on the moon, the rest was just, don't worry about it. They didn't worry about it until they landed. That's when they said it better work. Now, I think they should have said to me it better work 2 years earlier and said, and here's the proper funding and how much money do you need to make sure it better work. And they didn't do that, so... So it was interesting. I had no choice in it, and I was a young guy, and so I took everything to heart. I didn't have historic experience working for NASA. I'd been there 1 year, and so everything I heard was serious. I kid around a lot with people, but that's only because I had been around a long time. But when I was there at that point, a guy said, we got to jump off this bridge before we launch. I probably would have headed up there. Everything was, I'm listening to people that have been here. They're telling me I got to jump off a bridge. So, here I go.
Of course, as well as the Lunar TV, there was the Command Module TV.
Right. Other than the fact that, again, we were happy that it was working, and we had run our tests prior as to thresholds, et cetera. But I think on that particular mission, prior to landing, it was probably a high-priority TV. Once we landed, command module was kind of accepted as it's TV there and it's available, but we're all gearing up for the real stuff on the moon through this slow scan camera. After they left the moon, of course, command module TV again became very important as far as the public to see that the astronauts had returned to the command module and were on their way back. So we just felt more comfortable with command module TV because it wasn't this unique slow scan.
And on the way back, you had the crew reflecting on what had happened, didn't you? And put
yes, and I cannot honestly tell you a whole lot about what all they reflected on, because what I should tell you is because we were still in a bar somewhere drinking. you know, we didn't have a lot of the same duties we had as far as being at particular locations during day. Just like right now, there's a downlink coming from the ISS, and I'm at NASA. I'm not required to be over in control room with it. Okay, I'll get a call if there's a problem. So did we watch all the command module video after they returned? Well, of course we watched the initial, and we watched everything we could, but it became more and more kind of like a sigh of relief that you just met your goal, and you know, getting back was a big goal, but TV-wise, we just felt so much more comfortable. We weren't on pins and needles about it, so we didn't always watch 24/7 as to what they were saying. We would read about it or hear about it.
Well, next time, if you feel up to it, we can do Apollo 12.
Sure, the Hammer mission. Stan was always felt really bad for Bean.
Yeah.
And Bean kept apologizing, and, you know, I never saw it that way. I just see it like, you know, you're on the moon, and no one gave you, it's kind of like TV again. No one understood how TV worked compared to everything else on the spacecraft. So, yeah, hit with a hammer, whatever. You know? I doubt if he'd pound on the engine that way.
Probably not.
but it was TV.
Well, here in Sydney, we didn't have commercial color television then, but
yeah.
At the ATC headquarters, they set up a colour TV in their front window of their headquarters in Martin Place, and thousands of people crowded outside watching this live TV from the lunar surface, and, well, after a few minutes, they went home.
Yeah, oh, geez. that would have bothered me more than where I was seeing it happen. I mean, we'll talk about it, but it was a big letdown to all of us when they finally concluded that it's dead. We were really depressed, all the effort that went into that. I mean, this was only the second mission to the moon. So, yeah, that was a very depressing time. It was only rescued by the fact that as soon as that mission was over, we were 24/7 getting ready for the next one. And we all know what happened to that
one.
Yes,
that's right.
So now we got two missions, right? 14, and we got back to real TV from the moon.